From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with editors at two newspapers about their presidential endorsements. The Philadelphia Inquirer is doing something unprecedented. The paper is publishing 21 days of editorials, each focusing on a different reason to vote for Kerry. Each day on the opinion page, a guest writer makes the case for President Bush. We'll hear from the editorial page editor Chris Satullo and the opinion page editor John Tim Payne. In the predominantly Democratic city of Chicago, the Chicago Tribune has endorsed President Bush. The endorsement comes as no surprise, but it has generated an unusually large response. We'll hear from the editorial page editor Bruce Dold and the letters editor Dodie Hofstetter. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new biography of Shakespeare. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Democratic presidential challenger John Kerry is calling for big new investments in homeland security and accusing President Bush of not doing enough to keep America safe, NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Kerry promised to spend at least $60 billion over the next decade on efforts like policing borders, securing airports and bridges, and protecting the nation's chemical and nuclear sites from terrorist attack. Campaigning in Wisconsin today, Kerry said the country can't afford not to spend that money. He accused President Bush of shortchanging homeland security needs.
3 years after the most deadly attack in our nation's history, George Bush still hasn't done what's necessary to protect America because he's too busy protecting his tax cuts for the wealthy and the well-connected.
The Bush campaign counters that spending on homeland security has nearly tripled since 2001. Scott Horsley, NPR News, with the Kerry campaign, Las Vegas.
President Bush campaigned in Wisconsin this morning, telling supporters in La Crosse that he's the best candidate for small business owners. Steve Roysom reports from member station WLSU.
Mr. Bush says, unlike his opponent, Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry, he will not overtax small business owners. He says 7 out of 10 jobs come from small businesses, and he doesn't want to kill the entrepreneurial spirit.
Deep down, a lot of people in America want to run their own shop. Deep down, people have a desire to start their own business, and when they do, somebody is more likely to find a job.
The president and the first lady, Laura Bush, are traveling western Wisconsin and Iowa today by bus. In 2000, Mr. Bush nearly lost Wisconsin by less than 6,000 votes. For NPR News, I'm Steve Roysom in La Crosse, Wisconsin.
A state court in Florida has ruled that people who submitted incomplete voter registration forms won't be able to vote in next week's presidential election. The ruling came in a case brought by registrants who failed to check a box on the form confirming that they were U.S. citizens. The plaintiffs argued that their forms were valid because the signature at the bottom confirmed their American citizenship. Supporters of the lawsuit say the ruling will exclude about 14,000 potential voters in Florida. Israel's parliament has approved a withdrawal from the Gaza Strip and parts of the West Bank. NPR's Julie McCarthy says it's a victory for Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon.
The vote was 67 for the plan to pull out of Gaza, 45 against. There were 7 abstentions. This is a wider margin of victory than had been anticipated, and it represents a major victory for Ariel Sharon and a major transformation in his political inclinations.
NPR's Julie McCarthy. In stocks today, the Dow gained 138 points, or more than 1.4%, to close at 9,888 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq was up 14 to 1928. This is NPR News. Government safety investigators say the co-pilot caused the crash of American Airlines Flight 587 bound from New York City to the Dominican Republic in November of 2001. The National Transportation Safety Board heard testimony on the investigation today. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The NTSB probe found that Flight 587 ran into wake turbulence shortly after takeoff from JFK Airport. The co-pilot tried to recover by moving the plane's rudder back and forth rapidly. Investigator Robert Benson said that effort ended up causing the plane's rear stabilizer to shear off.
The first officer's control wheel and rudder inputs during the second wake encounter were unnecessary and too aggressive, and the American Airlines Advanced Aircraft Maneuvering Program Ground School encouraged pilots to use rudder during recovery from upsets.
Investigators blamed American Airlines for not training pilots to avoid sudden stress on the stabilizer. American Airlines has said Airbus did not warn pilots about the danger of such movements. The crash killed 260 passengers and 5 people on the ground. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
14 hotels in San Francisco say they won't abide by a call from Mayor Gavin Newsom to end their lockout of unionized workers. Some 4,000 union bellhops, maids, cooks, and other workers have been kept off the job during contract talks with the hotel operators. The operators locked them out of 10 hotels after the union called a strike at 4 others. The mayor threatened yesterday to call for a boycott of the hotels if they didn't call the workers back during a 90-day cooling-off period. Newsom said he would join workers on the picket lines today. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from White Wave, the maker of Silk, all-natural organic soy milk, a cholesterol-free way to start the day. Silk, rise and shine.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're going to talk with the editors of 2 newspapers about their presidential endorsements. A little later we'll hear about the Chicago Tribune's endorsement of President Bush. The Philadelphia Inquirer is doing something unprecedented in its endorsement of John Kerry. It's publishing 21 editorials over 21 days in a series called 21 Reasons to Vote for Kerry. Each editorial expands on the differences between Kerry and Bush in one area, ranging from Homeland Security to Head Start. Opposite the editorial, on the commentary page each day, is a piece by a guest writer who supports Bush. My guests are Chris Satullo, the editorial page editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and John Timpane, the editor of the commentary page. I asked Chris Satullo if the editorial board wanted to emphasize its endorsement with a 21-day series because Philadelphia is in a swing state.
Very clearly, one reason why we did this is we know Pennsylvania is a close battleground state, and we know that it's quite likely that that battleground will be decided in the suburbs of Philadelphia, where we circulate, where we're the dominant newspaper, and where we think we have some of our most loyal readers who know us and know how we argue points and might actually be interested in our reasoning. You know, the point of an endorsement really is not just naming a name. It's the argument you make, you know, the facts you marshal, the way you interpret them. And nobody votes for a president simply because a newspaper says that. But what we do is we enter the larger conversation. We give people some things to think about. We maybe reframe some issues for them, give them some facts they didn't know before, and that enters into their thinking. We don't think anybody is going to change their mind because we endorse somebody.
Now, the fact that the Philadelphia Inquirer is running 21 days of editorials in support of John Kerry is just half of the story. The other half of the story is on each of those 21 days, you're running a commentary on the commentary page, taking the opposite point of view and supporting President Bush. John Timpane, you edit those commentaries. Why did you decide, and how did you decide at the Inquirer to have each day of the editorial opposed with a commentary?
Well, we decided it at the very moment that we decided to do the first 21-part series. We said, well, we can't just say, yay, Kerry, every day. We should balance it on the op-ed page. And after all, the words op-ed mean opposite to the editorial position. So we went out and we tried to find the very best writers that we could for the conservative rebuttal.
Now, what are your criteria for the very best? I mean, we're living in a time when a lot of people think the very best are the people who, like, spin most convincingly. So what were you looking for in terms of, like, factual background, expertise, spin? You know, like, what were your criteria?
My main criterion was who has written excellently about this in the past for the conservative side. So, for example, who would counter our big editorial against the war in Iraq? Well, I felt David Frum was the best person because he has written a book with Richard Pearl about putting forward very eloquently, as well as you could do it, the case for the war in Iraq, the case for unilateral military action. And so in David's case, he was one of the first people we called. when the issue came up of Kerry's values. Who's the best person to write about values? Well, I thought Bill Bennett, despite his recent troubles, I thought he's still a very eloquent spokesperson for conservative values. When we get to Homeland Security, why not have Tom Ridge? For one thing, he used to be our governor. For another thing, he's got standing. He knows, or he should know, what his agency is doing. So it had to do with who had already established a track record as a very good spokesperson for this.
What's the fact-checking like? Like, say somebody makes a statement that you know is pure spin and it's not really true. Are you going to say, you can't really say this because it's not factually accurate, it's just spin?
Yes. Yeah, I've done it an awful lot already. I've done it, 20, 30 times. I've called people back and said, we already know this isn't true.
Give me an example of one of those
commentaries. Well, I don't want to name the writer,
sure.
but one of the writers tried to say that Kerry has already been discredited for his service in Vietnam. He has not been, and so I said, you can't say that. We had a fight about it, and we won.
I want to add that in terms of writing commentaries, we give leeway to interpret and characterize facts to the writers so that they can make their case.
Sure.
And nothing goes in with their name on it if they don't feel that their case has been made, even if they aren't totally happy. And in the editing of the editorials get bounced back to the writers. And I tell them,
absolutely,
we can't say that. We haven't nailed that. That point doesn't make sense. Where's your source on that? What's your information on that?
I think there's a difference between irresponsible bloviation and being very opinionated. And I want my op-ed writers to be very opinionated. They have every right to feel that with the Inquirer's weight behind a 21-part series for John Kerry, they have every right to feel that they should have a big stage in which to air their grievances. But I don't want them to lie. And, we don't want any lies anywhere in the newspaper.
Now, you want your 21 editorials to really carry a lot of weight and to help inform your readers before going to the polls. I'm wondering if the Kerry Edwards campaign has quoted any of the editorials in their ads or in their literature.
Not that I'm aware of. I've seen that they've posted them on their blog. One thing I just want to make real clear to everyone is we had no communication with the Kerry Edwards campaign before or during this project. We haven't talked to them to get any information. We're doing our own reporting,
absolutely,
and our own writing. There's just absolutely no connection with the Kerry campaign whatsoever.
I mean, ironically, I've had a lot of connection with the Bush-Cheney campaign, and certainly, involving the displeasure and discomfort of certain parties.
We've had some very entertaining conversations.
Well, we're about to get to that, and let me ask you about the letters that you've been receiving. The editorials, the 21 days of editorials, is unprecedented. Is the nature of the letters that you're getting unprecedented as well?
We've received, at a certain point, you stop counting, but at least 1,500 responses to the series via email, letters, or phone calls, probably running 3-1 against.
Against your editorials?
I hesitate to say against the editorials, against the idea of the project. I have to say that it seems to me that very, very few of the people who are writing in have even actually seen the newspaper.
Yeah.
What happened was the Bush-Cheney campaign put out an email to its mailing list, which told people that we were doing this horrible, horrible, illegitimate thing, and mentioned only that we were writing the 21 editorials and never mentioned the 21 rejoinders from Bush supporters.
Right.
It was an extremely unfair and unbalanced description of what we were doing, and a lot of the email we're getting from around the country clearly is a response to that distortion.
Bush-Cheney actually have been cooperating with me in getting some of the pieces. All the time that they have been doing this other campaign, they've been working with us to get pieces on the page. So it's a rather ironic.
So in other words, if you want somebody high-powered within the Bush-Cheney camp, they'll help you get them.
Absolutely, with bells on, yes.
Mm-hmm,
right,
mm-hmm.
I called someone with the Bush-Cheney campaign to try in a somewhat good-natured way. I called up and said, hello, it's the Antichrist, also known as Chris Atul. I just asked, do you really think it's fair to send out this email to all these people and not mention that you're working with us on the rebuttal pieces? And the reply of the person in the Bush-Cheney campaign was, it's not my job to be fair. It's my job to reelect the president of the United States.
What does that tell you about the political process?
Well, he's right. I mean, that is his job.
Yeah.
That didn't tell us anything we didn't know. It's when it's done to you that it wakes you up a little bit, and it's been done us.
Right. I have these shreds of naive idealism, which after 30 years of covering politics, I should have scoured away. And I'm sure, people on the other side would would be as intent on discrediting what we're doing had we endorsed President Bush. But I don't want to leave the impression that many of our ordinary readers didn't write in. They did write in. Some of them were extremely unhappy. Some of them were very happy. We had a couple of people calling up nearly in tears. I mean, we've had praising us, saying, you know, finally a newspaper with guts. Now, they're very much outnumbered by our readers who are unhappy and saw that as a piece of a long history of partisan bias or liberal bias in the entire newspaper. The other point I'd just like to make is that normally our editorial page is centrist. When we endorse in congressional races, we're pretty much split down the middle, Republican and Democrat. We've supported things like school vouchers, moment of silence in schools. We try to take a fresh and non-ideological and unpredictable look at a lot of issues. This particular president, this particular campaign has left us feeling that it's much more important to make sure that the hard right revolution that is occurring isn't completed than it is to be perfectly centrist. So at times we find ourselves aligned in this election or sounding like very liberal elements of the Democratic Party who in a normal period of time we would be criticizing fairly strongly.
Well, I think so many newspaper readers are really confused. How can it be that you can say the reporters are unbiased in their coverage, that there's an editorial page that is all about offering opinion?
Terry, I think you're on to a really great point, which is that people in the newspaper business seem to think that everybody understands what we're doing, even though we never bother to explain it. Even the very term editorial board is confusing because it sounds like we're running the newspaper. That's what it sounds like an editorial board does. I've come to the conclusion that after this is done, whenever this election is decided, December, January, whenever we find out who's won, when the dust clears, I think we're going to change the name of the editorial page and the editorial board because I think it's deeply confusing to people and the tradition is not worth the confusion. I think we should call it the opinion page and I think we should call it the opinion board, and that would make what we do as opposed to what the news side reporters and editors do much clearer to people.
Now, what about the publisher? You're part of the Knight Ridder chain. Mm-hmm. Can the publisher ever intervene and say, I don't like the idea of you doing 21 editorials endorsing John Kerry, or I don't like the op-eds you've been running. Those opinion pieces aren't strong enough. Mm. Here's my list of people who I think would be stronger. Print them. Does the publisher ever intervene like that?
Technically, and again, this is one of these mysteries of the news business that we don't explain very well, but the editorial page is the publisher's page. He is actually the chair of the editorial board at our paper and at most papers. So he has every right to do whatever he wants. But in my 10 years on the editorial board at the Inquirer, it has never happened that the publisher has countermanded a decision of the board. They take part in the discussion sometimes, some of the higher profile things, and they have their say. In this case, Joe Natoli, our publisher, approved the project. He, you know, I wouldn't ever do something like this without reviewing it with him. His emphasis from day one and all the way through has been, what are we doing for balance? But he's behind the series 100%.
Now, the publisher has to worry about the bottom line. What kind of impact, if any, do you think your 21 days of endorsements for Kerry have been getting from subscribers, newsstand buyers, and advertisers?
I think the latest number of people who've called to threaten to cancel their subscription as opposed to actually following through with it is around 600 to 700, which is not something you take lightly in this world of newspapers where we're fighting every year to increase circulation slightly or to stay even. But the publisher and the people on the business side of the paper know this is part of what a newspaper is and does, and it's part of being a strong voice in the community. And in the end, they realize that the stronger a voice we have, the more effective we are at grabbing our community's attention and holding it, the better the newspaper is. It's no fun talking to people, and I've called a lot of them and talked to them. Mm-hmm. It is no fun talking to people who feel this badly about something you've done that they're thinking of breaking what is in some cases a 30 or 40 year relationship with you as a reader. But if we'd endorsed George Bush, an equal or perhaps greater number of people would have canceled.
My guests are Chris Sotulo, editorial page editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and John Tim Payne, editor of the Commentary Page. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Chris Sotulo, editorial page editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and John Tim Payne, editor of the Commentary Page. The paper is running a series of 21 editorials, each offering another reason to vote for Kerry. During this election, and for the past few years, really, there have been charges that newspapers that have always been seen as pretty mainstream and TV networks that have been seen as pretty mainstream are actually really liberal. And this kind of charge is being leveled at news coverage at a lot of newspapers, not just the editorial page. So how is that affecting the Philadelphia Inquirer?
Yeah, we get that charge all the time, and it is not without substance. More and more, as I get further into this job and spend more and more of my time exchanging emails and talking to conservatives who make this complaint, I see what it is about newspapers that drives them crazy over their cornflakes in the morning. I do see lapses in fairness or understanding or perspective more often than I used to. What frustrates me about this conversation is that it is true that we need to sit back, we being journalists, sit back and do a reassessment to make sure that we haven't gotten into some reflexes and some bad habits that really are unfair to our readership. But most of the complaints about bias that I hear assume a kind of partisan ideological agenda on the part of newspapers. And that's why I think that argument falls on deaf ears so often, because if you work in a newspaper, you know that it's some of the most skeptical, non-ideological people in the world tend to gravitate towards journalism. There is no way in which we sit around a big oak table in the morning and say, okay, how can we slant the news to help the Democrats? I mean, that simply doesn't happen. But that's the way the charge of bias is frequently framed. So it's very easy to say, oh, we're not doing that, so we're fine. We probably aren't doing what our critics are saying, but that doesn't mean that we're fine. We're still making mistakes.
What are the mistakes?
I think it's a failure of perspective. If you take an issue like gay marriage, Dan Okren, who's the public editor for the New York Times, wrote a wonderful piece saying that the New York Times, when the issue of gay marriage was hot, when the weddings were happening in San Francisco and Boston, I don't have the exact numbers, wrote something like 55 pieces about the issue. And only three of those pieces spent much time talking about the possibility that this wasn't a good thing for America. Most of them were celebratory in sort of their tone or their approach to the news. That's clearly not balanced coverage when you know that a certain segment of your readership thinks this is really a terrible development. And I'm not making a comment one way or another on gay marriage, but if you're covering an issue of controversy like that, it's clear that you have to make sure that you have some sympathetic understanding of the perspective that says what's happening in Massachusetts and San Francisco is bad for the country.
Chris Sotulo, in Sunday's paper, you had a column in which you were talking about the expression the liberal elite. Mm-hmm. And you were talking about how, although you're from a working class town in or suburb in Ohio, because of the work that you do now, you would be, in this narrative, described as part of the liberal media elite.
Right.
What's going on there, do you think, with that expression? How is that expression being used now, and why do you distrust it?
There is a conservative narrative that's been growing for 30 years in the country that basically explains what's gone wrong with the country and how it's gone right. And in this narrative, what's gone wrong with the country is the media and the levers of government were essentially subject to a hostile takeover by an arrogant liberal elite that involves people that go to colleges in mostly New England, who are very cosmopolitan in outlook, have a kind of sneering contempt for the values of mainstream America. Think NASCAR is stupid. Think country music is stupid. They come out of the 60s. They devoted their time in the 60s to sex, drugs, and Led Zeppelin and draft dodging. You know, this whole narrative. So every time I write something that's critical of President Bush, which is, I admit, not been an infrequent occurrence this year, I get email where people say, well, we know who you are, and here's why we can dismiss everything you have to say. You're part of this elite that's immoral, that doesn't believe in God. Parenthetical mention, I'm an Episcopalian. But they're sure I'm an atheist. They're sure that I spent most of the 1960s on mescaline and LSD. They're sure of all these things. And it's a way of not really dealing with what I might have to say or in anything, you know, any argument I make that has some substance, because they can put me over there. I'm part of an elite that is, in their mind, discredited. you know, and I know lots of these people. They're my neighbors. I still live in the suburbs. I get along great with them when we're not talking about politics, when we're watching football or playing golf or having a cookout. So I realize that this is not fully part of their attitude. It's just something they use as a defense mechanism when it's politics is what the question is.
Do you feel that the Bush campaign is using this narrative?
Sure. I mean, I think it's a narrative that has worked politically for the Republican Party for a long time. It speaks to something real, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's not that there isn't an arrogant liberal elite, and it's not that there aren't people who are contemptuous of mainstream American values. So they have something real that they can plug into. And I think President Bush, with his kind of studied inarticulateness, his mangled syntax, his swagger, his work shirts, the way he talks about John Kerry, you know, Massachusetts liberal, is plugging into that.
And finally, do you think that there will be contested votes on Election Day in the area that you cover, in the greater Philadelphia area, the Delaware Valley?
I think it's almost a certainty.
I've always said it was a blessing from God that it was Florida that was tied and not Pennsylvania, because I would never want anybody to come in and lift the rock in Philadelphia and see how we actually tally votes there.
What's the problem?
Well, as in many cities still, I mean, there is a system here, and things can get lost if people don't like the way things turn out, and it's. But I also think that's true of the state in general. It is not the best organized place as far as collecting the votes and tallying the votes.
Now, this is a Democratic machine town, Philadelphia.
Absolutely.
Our paper several years ago did a major investigation on how Democrats stole a state Senate election doing monkey business with absentee ballots. The election was overturned by a federal judge as a result of our reporting. This may seem hard to believe to people elsewhere, but in Philadelphia, there are voting machines in people's living rooms. You go into a private home to vote in places in Philadelphia, and that person is often a Democratic precinct committee person in whose home you're voting. So there's a lot of stuff that happens in Philly that I'd like to see get fixed. I think there are examples of stuff like that all over the country.
You know, I'm praying every day that we don't, that it's not that close here. I'm praying really hard.
Do you have a prediction about whether it will be?
I do, and it will remain with me.
Very good. And Chris, you feel the same way?
I think it'll be close. I would suspect that Kerry's going to win Pennsylvania, because I think there's just going to be enormous turnout in the city of Philadelphia, and a lot of it will actually be valid. There's just a tremendous amount of feeling among minority voters in this city that minority voters were disenfranchised last time. And even if they're not that thrilled about John Kerry, I think that will effectively motivate them.
Thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
Chris Atullo is the editorial page editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. John Timpane edits the commentary page. We'll hear about the Chicago Tribune's endorsement of President Bush in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Spectra Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Fevre Dream and Dying of the Light by George R.R. Martin, author of A Storm of Swords. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's no surprise that the Chicago Tribune endorsed President Bush, but it's generated an unusually large response. Coming up, we talk with the Tribune's editorial page editor, Bruce Dold, and letters editor, Dodie Hofstetter. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new biography of Shakespeare. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the first half of the show, we talked about the Philadelphia Inquirer's endorsement of John Kerry. In the largely Democratic city of Chicago, the Chicago Tribune has endorsed President Bush. The endorsement came as no surprise to readers, but the response has been unusually large. My guests are Bruce Dold, the Tribune's editorial page editor, and Dodie Hofstetter, the letters editor. I asked Dold why the Tribune endorsed President Bush.
The editorial starts out by quoting John McCain, saying that every generation has a fundamental challenge that it faces. And the fundamental challenge facing this generation is the war on terror. So much of the editorial focuses on that. To our mind, and what the editorial says is that President Bush has taken a more aggressive stance on the war on terror, to the point of saying that we will act preemptively, while John Kerry has taken more of a law enforcement view, that we will respond when we are attacked. Kerry has not ruled out preemptive action, but it seems to be a distinction in their views on that issue, and that was the paramount issue for us. We criticize both of them on spending policy, pointing out that, yes, the president has left the nation with massive red ink. However, when you look at the Concord Coalition's assessment of both of these candidates, they would both create massive more red ink for the nation. The president largely through tax cuts, and President Kerry largely through spending. We are uncomfortable with how John Kerry has handled the fundamental issue of Iraq, and point out that he did vote, as many people know, he voted for the Iraq resolution. And it seemed to support an effort that would lead to likely intervention in Iraq when that was expedient for him, when Howard Dean gave him a hard time from the left in the Democratic primaries. That's when John Kerry became an anti-war candidate. So that didn't give us a lot of comfort all around. We pick apart some of the arguments that are used against Bush. One is that he always acts unilaterally. We point out that he has sought coalitions. He has sought coalitions in how we deal with North Korea, how we deal with murder in Sudan, genocide in Sudan, how we deal with Iran. So those were the basic parameters of the endorsement.
Your endorsement includes this sentence: "This year, each of us has the privilege of choosing between two major party candidates whose integrity, intention, and abilities are exemplary." Why did you include words of praise for both of the candidates in your editorial?
Because I think they both deserve words of praise. When we discuss John Kerry's views and where we disagree with him, we are not going to make this a character issue. I think the whole tenor of this campaign has been unfortunate in many ways, the sense that the other side has no leg to stand on. And we'll get into this when we talk about the reaction to this. But many of the people who reacted, it wasn't with a sense that I profoundly disagree with you. It was with a sense that it is unfathomable to me that anyone takes an alternative view of these two candidates. I suppose that was an endorsement that could have gone further to try and trash John Kerry, but we don't want to trash John Kerry. On fundamental views, we sided with George Bush. On terms of character, we find a lot to like in both these candidates.
Let me bring Dodie Hofstetter into this conversation, who edits the letters for the Chicago Tribune. And, it's no surprise, I suppose, that you'd endorse President Bush, but was the reaction surprising to that, Dodie?
The action was very surprising. I've received more letters for this than I have for almost any other topic in the 6 years I've been editing the Voice of the People section, which is where we run the letters. The other thing that was very surprising to me was the tone was very negative, very nasty in a lot of cases. We did get a lot of letters that just, as Bruce was saying, they just couldn't believe, our stupidity and our heads in the sand in endorsing President Bush. And that surprised me that they were surprised, I guess, because of our tradition, because of the conservative history we have with the Tribune. And I'm surprised that people were as surprised as they are.
Is there perhaps a letter you've brought with you that has the kind of tone that you're describing that is different than the typical letters that you get?
What I tried to do in the letters that I chose to publish was to pick the more thoughtful ones, the ones that were representative of what we received, but also, didn't carry quite the nasty tone. One that we ran center of our Sunday column said, "Surprise, surprise," and ends with, "If Mickey Mouse were the Republican candidate for president, he would be certain of an endorsement," as just saying, no thought went into this and that it would have been anybody just as long as the Republican candidate. The others were more thoughtful, I think, that we did get a mix. We did receive some from people who were pleased with our choice. And those people tended to, I think, more articulate that their main concern is safety and that they felt George Bush is doing a good job with that and keeping them safe, and that they feel that sticking with George Bush is going to keep them safe for the next 4 years.
Could you tell if there was any organized letter writing campaign or phone call campaign?
That was another surprise, actually, for the endorsement letters. We have received so many letters from the end of September through last Friday was the last time I tallied them. And in a normal month, we get between 4,800 and 7,000 letters. But up until October 22nd, we have received more than 11,000 letters. And they started to really come in after the debates began. The debates produced such a letter-writing campaign, mostly a liberal letter-writing campaign, that we traced back to, for instance, the Democratic National Committee website, telling people exactly what to say, and we could tell the letters right away were the same wording. They all arrived. Many arrived before the debates even began, saying that they felt that John Kerry had won the debates.
I think a lot of newspaper readers are confused. How is it that they're told reporters are fair and neutral in their reporting, yet the editorial page takes a strong position on things as important as elections? So how do you explain that the difference between reporting and editorial to your readers?
If you go back, even 60, 70 years in American newspapers, there wasn't a difference. The front page of the Chicago Tribune in 1931 on Election Day was "Vote for Cermak Today." Now, that happened to be when the Tribune had a real crusade to oust the last Republican mayor of Chicago. It's an example where the Tribune wasn't in lockstep with any, with a particular party. It is over that last half century or so that newspapers have been much more conscious about needing to, to establish that their news coverage is unbiased. The editorial board is a group of people who do only that. We are the opinion function of the newspaper. We go out of our way not to to influence the reporting coverage. Now, we get a lot of complaints from people who say that news coverage is biased. That's a common complaint around the country. And all we can tell people is we specifically, there is a firewall, and we do not influence their coverage. We'll talk to them about issues. We'll get background from them. But every effort is made from the editor and publisher on down to assure that reporters don't feel that they should be swayed one way or the other because of what the editorial page says.
Now, the Chicago Tribune owns several other papers, and I'm wondering if the publisher ever overrules your opinion.
Well, I think what you're going to is whether the corporate body has an influence, and the publisher is the publisher of the Chicago Tribune, just as there's a separate publisher of the Baltimore Sun and Newsday and the other papers that the Tribune owns. From what I've seen so far, most of the newspapers in the Tribune company have endorsed John Kerry. The Hartford Courant, one of our papers, endorsed Bush. We endorsed Bush. I haven't seen the L.A. Times yet. The L.A. Times had a practice of not of making presidential endorsements, and they were weighing whether to break that rule this time. Our papers in Florida endorsed John Kerry. So each paper is making its own determination, its own individual determination, based on where that newspaper stands. At the Chicago Tribune, as at most papers, the publisher does have the authority, if he wish, he or she wishes to exercise it, to overrule the editorial board to set policy. As a matter of course, I don't think that's happened once since I've been the editor of the editorial page.
My guests are Bruce Dold, editorial page editor of the Chicago Tribune, and Dodie Hofstetter, the Tribune's letters editor. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Bruce Dold, the editorial page editor of the Chicago Tribune, and Dodie Hofstetter, the Tribune's letters editor. We're talking about the paper's endorsement of President Bush. One of your editorials recently was an endorsement of Barack Obama for Illinois senator over his opponent, Alan Keyes. And was that a tough choice for you? You describe Alan Keyes as from the right wing of the right wing of the Republican Party. And so clearly you find Alan Keyes a little distasteful. But was it difficult for you to end up endorsing the Democrat Barack Obama? Did you wish that there was a stronger Republican to support?
No, I felt very good about that endorsement, and I think there was unanimity on the editorial page on that endorsement. And you know, we had Barack Obama in the Illinois legislature had worked on a number of issues, on welfare reform, on criminal justice reform, that the paper, the editorial page, and the news pages have been very, very much involved with. So we have a long record of knowing where he came from, knowing what he saw as critical issues, and being on the same side of many of those critical issues with him. It would have been a more interesting race in Illinois if Jack Ryan, who won the Republican nomination, had stayed on the ballot. But as we said in the Obama endorsement, our decision, and we think the voters' decision, would have been the same. What I like about Barack Obama is that he makes a great effort to get past partisanship. You hear him on the stump, you hear him when he's speaking to groups, and he talks, as he did at the Democratic convention, about one nation. He doesn't take the bait. He doesn't come across as shrill. He will criticize Republicans when he disagrees with them on issues. But he really, I think, wants to change the tone of politics in the country. And I think that's a great thing. Also, I think, the editorial page often talks about a culture of corruption in Illinois politics, and you see it in other states as well. And I think Barack Obama has an extremely high ethical standard. He's a very, very honest person, a hardworking person, and all of that went into a very heartfelt endorsement of him.
Since you describe Alan Keyes as being from the right wing of the right wing of the Republican Party, what's one or two of the more outrageous things that he said that would have made it impossible for you to consider endorsing him?
Oh, I think his comments about Mary Cheney simply were personalized an issue. And I think that was the point at which many Republicans in the state turned him off. You know, this is an evangelism effort, not really a political campaign.
You want to mention what it is you're referring to, the hedonist quote?
When he at the Republican convention, he was asked about lesbianism, and he said that gays are what was the quote? Selfish hedonists, and that just kind of awoke a lot of people here. But I think before that, the party made a decision that it wanted a high profile candidate when Jack Ryan got out of the race. And it settled on Alan Keyes. Now, this was a guy who had, barely registered when he'd been the Republican candidate for Senate in his own state in Maryland. I don't think he ever got more than a third of the vote. So they just made a colossally bad judgment call and decided to hand the Republican nomination to him.
Now, with Jack Ryan having dropped out of the Senate race because of a personal little sex scandal, and then with Alan Keyes being considered pretty extreme, What state is that leaving the Republican Party in Illinois in?
We did two things on Sunday. We endorsed Barack Obama in the Senate race, and we had a second editorial basically saying, "Wake up, Republicans! What do you got yourself into?" And we said that there should be two lessons from recent experience here. One is that they have to have candidates who talk about ethics. We just gone through one of the reasons that the Republican Party is in such sad shape as it is in Illinois is the corrupt administration of former Governor George Ryan, who's gotten a lot of attention around the country for his stance on the death penalty, but is also under indictment now on corruption charges. The Republicans are still reeling from that. So, you know, what we said is you've got to have candidates who will reflect that, who said we need to get past that. We need ethics in government. Illinois isn't exactly known for ethics in government as Louisiana and New Jersey. The second point we made was that the folks on the Illinois State Central Committee who thought that Alan Keyes was a good choice for the Senate are out of touch with the mainstream of the state. The Republican Party had a 25-year run in the governor's office in the state because it put up practical conservative candidates, and it has gotten away from that. It got away from that with the choice of Alan Keyes. So I think, again, you know, coming from where the Tribune comes from, we may have some impact on the Republican Party that another newspaper that doesn't have a known ideology would. People do pay attention to what the paper has to say on those issues.
Bruce Dold, I'm wondering what you think about this. You know, the Philadelphia Inquirer is the editorial board is so strong in its support of John Kerry that they're writing 21 editorials over 21 days, each editorial giving, you know, expanding on another reason why they're endorsing John Kerry. What do you think of that?
I think that's tremendous. I mean, I think that's terrific, and I think the last presidential election, we did, I would say, more of a concerted effort. We had more issues analysis on the editorial page than we did this time. Our news section did issues analysis. When you're in a swing state, as Pennsylvania is, that's a great effort to undertake. And I'm also glad to hear that they're putting, other opinions of, Bush supportive pieces on the op-ed page. That's exactly what an editorial page should do.
Did you feel that Illinois is being a little overlooked in this election? You're not a swing state, so people, the presidential candidates aren't actively, courting the vote of the people of Illinois. You're not seeing as many ads as the people in swing states do. And, let's face it, Barack Obama really has this senatorial election wrapped up, so there's probably not a whole lot of media action on that one either.
Yeah, we feel like we're missing an action. I mean, we've supported the Electoral College, but I'll have to think twice about it. You do feel like you're missing something. Now, we're surrounded just about by swing states. I mean, you can go to Wisconsin and get a taste of the presidential election. But it is kind of an odd feeling, especially in a state that did get a lot of focus in presidential elections in the past, to feel that this one is just passing you by.
Why did you support the Electoral College in an editorial?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm rethinking it now. I mean, I think we are reluctant to make changes in the Constitution, and I don't know, given the track record, in presidential elections, it was exceedingly rare to have happen what happened in 2000. I think there were at the time of the founding fathers decided to put the time the Electoral College was created, there was an argument to be made on parceling out representation and influence. I think if you took it away, Iowa would no longer count. Most of the focus would be on the population centers, and I don't know that would be good for the country. But conversely, now as you see it is not particularly good for the country that New York and Illinois and Massachusetts and states that are not in play essentially are almost forgotten.
Bruce Dold, Dodie Hofstetter, thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bruce Dold is the editorial page editor of the Chicago Tribune. Dodie Hofstetter is the Tribune's letters editor. Earlier, we heard from two editors of the Philadelphia Inquirer, which has endorsed John Kerry. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new biography of Shakespeare. This is Fresh Air. Stephen Greenblatt's new biography of Shakespeare, called Will in the World, has just been nominated for the National Book Award. But critic Maureen Corrigan says that regardless of the outcome of that nomination, Greenblatt's book is a winner.
Reading Will in the World is like taking a walking tour through Elizabethan England, Shakespeare's life, and the imaginative universe of his plays and sonnets. That's what I told a friend who likes to read, but who was put off by the thought of reading this biography of the Bard by Harvard professor and renowned Shakespeare scholar Stephen Greenblatt. Just as Shakespeare's plays pitch themselves at both the illiterate groundlings swarming the stage and the more knowledgeable big spenders in the gallery, so too Greenblatt's superb book speaks to an audience of curious general readers, as well as to those who've studied Shakespeare and surrendered themselves to the spell of his language time and again. Greenblatt, in effect, says fie to the fear that Shakespeare is for smarties only, and pays tribute to the glorious democracy of Shakespeare's art by the openness and easy elegance of his own writing style. Will in the World is subtitled How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare. And as Greenblatt readily admits, any biography of Shakespeare must rely a lot on guesswork, since besides property records, so few documents in Shakespeare's hand, no letters, no marginalia, no first drafts, exist. But there's guesswork, and then there's inspired, vastly knowledgeable guesswork. Greenblatt, as a scholarly sleuth, is in this latter Sherlock Holmes category. He takes on this daunting case because of his overwhelming conviction that Shakespeare's plays and poems spring not only from other plays and poems, but from the things he knew firsthand in his body and soul. The central and enduring mystery here is how Shakespeare, a modestly educated young man from the sticks, whose father was a glove maker, broke into and conquered the inbred theater world of London and ultimately became the greatest playwright of all time. To piece together a likely story, Greenblatt draws upon his exhaustive knowledge of the politics and culture of Elizabethan England. Greenblatt is also a great close reader of Shakespeare's sonnets and plays, where he ferrets out some of the most convincing clues to Shakespeare's life. Throughout his book, for instance, Greenblatt discusses how Shakespeare became, in effect, the Bard, and yet never forgot where he came from. Greenblatt looks closely at the famous scene in A Midsummer Night's Dream, where the troupe of artisans, among them the weaver Nick Bottom and the carpenter Peter Quince, perform a catastrophically bad play within a play and are jeered by an audience of their betters. Greenblatt says in this scene, the young Shakespeare is proclaiming his own move from rustic amateurism to urban sophistication. But Greenblatt goes on to say this. What saves this scene of ridicule from becoming too painful is the self-possession of the artisans. In the face of open derision, they are unflappable. Shakespeare achieved a double effect. On the one hand, he mocked the amateurs. On the other, he conferred an odd, unexpected dignity upon Bottom and his fellows, a dignity that contrasts favorably with the sardonic rudeness of the aristocratic spectators. Even as he called attention to the distance between himself and the rustic performers then, Shakespeare doubled back and signaled a current of sympathy and solidarity. There's a wealth of psychological insights like that one in Greenblatt's book, and if even a quarter of them truly hit the mark, then our knowledge of Shakespeare the man has been profoundly augmented. I wish, for example, that I had the infinite space to convey the brilliance of Greenblatt's discussion of the biographical sources for Hamlet. That tragedy has baffled scholars who can't account for its explosion of language. Shakespeare added over 600 new words in Hamlet, both to his own canon and many to the written record of English itself. Nor have critics adequately accounted for the unprecedented representation of tormented inwardness that marks its soliloquies. Greenblatt suggests the solution involves a deep shock in Shakespeare's life and says the death of Shakespeare's son Hamnet in 1596, about 4 years before he wrote the play, was that very shock. Greenblatt ties in that personal tragedy to the starker relationship to the dead imposed by the Protestant Reformation. What ceremony else, cries Laertes, standing at the grave of his sister Ophelia? What ceremony else, Greenblatt suggests, Shakespeare himself might have silently cried, denied the comforting funeral rituals of Catholicism. In the context of the case Greenblatt has already made for Shakespeare's father being a closet Catholic, the idea that the bard would have conjured up Hamlet's spirit-haunted world as a way of affirming the Catholic belief in an ongoing relationship between the living and the dead makes emotional and historical sense. But I digress. If I, like Shakespeare, could concoct words out of air, I do so to rave about Will in the World. As a work of biography, scholarship, and imagination, it deserves a new vocabulary of praise.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Will in the World by Stephen Greenblatt. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Weird U.S., your travel guide to America's local legends and best-kept secrets, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Alzheimer's Association, encouraging Americans to learn about ways to reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease, on the web at alz.org, and from Harcourt, publishers of A Tale of Love and Darkness, the memoir of growing up in war-torn Jerusalem, and the life of Israeli writer Amos Oz, author of The Same Sea. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Dan Seligson of electionline.org. He edited their report, Election Preview 2004, What's Changed, What Hasn't, and Why. And we talk with reporter David Margalek of Vanity Fair. He interviewed several Supreme Court clerks about what happened behind the scenes in Bush v. Gore. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.